Fletch did not mind telephoning Five Aces Farm that early in the morning. Horse people are always up early. The phone rang so long without being answered, Fletch sat at the desk. Finally, a man's voice answered. "This is Fletcher. May I speak with Mr. Sills, please?"
"Not here, Mr. Fletcher. This is Max Frizzlewit."
"Morning, Max. Ted must have been off pretty early. Is there a race somewhere?"
"Yep, there's a race, but he's not at it. I'm just about to go with the trailer. Except the phone kept ringing and ringing down here at the stables. One of your horses, too, Mr. Fletcher."
Frizzlewit sped along in his English accent.
"Scarlet Pimpernickel. Call to wish her luck."
"Does she have a chance?"
"Nope. If she had half a chance, we would have moved her to the track yesterday. She's not worth stable fees."
"Then why are you running her?"
"She needs the exercise."
"Oh, good.
She needs the experience."
"Will she ever be any good, Max?"
"Nope."
"Then why do I own her?"
"Beats me. She may have looked good that week you were here."
"Never again?"
"And never before, I think."
"Maybe I brought something out in her."
"Maybe. You ought to come by more often, Mr. Fletcher."
"To buy more horses?"
"You ought to go to the track."
"It's too embarrassing, Max."
"Maybe if you went to the track, old Scarlet Pimpernickel would perform for you. Keep her eye on the finish instead of on a bunch of horses' asses."
If only the horses he trained ran as fast as Frizzlewit talked. "This horse has an anal fixation, is that it?"
"I'm not sure she's an actual pervert, Mr. Fletcher. It just may be that she'd never seen anything but other horses' asses."
"Very understanding of you, Frizzlewit."
"Hey, you have to be in this business. Horses are just like people."
"No," Fletch said, "they're smarter. They don't invest in people and make them run around a track."
"That's true. They are smarter that way."
"So where did Mr. Sills go?"
"He left the country."
"Ah, was this a sudden trip, would you say?"
"He packed and left last night. He was planning to go to the race today."
"A sudden trip. Did he mention which country he's favoring?"
"France. He mentioned France."
"And which way he was going?"
"By airplane, Mr. Fletcher."
"I mean, through Miami, New York?"
"Atlanta, I think."
"Then he's gone. Left the country."
"Can't be sure. Cousin Heath from Piddle. You know I had a cousin lives in Piddle. Came to see me and got into that Atlanta airport and wasn't heard from Tuesday noon till Saturday tea time. Said he kept expecting something to happen and nothing did."
"I'm going to tell people to keep their eye on you, Frizzlewit."
"Wish you would. Sometimes it gets lonely down here with the horses."
"Even you can outrun them, huh?"
"Some of them are no improvement over staying still."
"Will Mr. Sills call you?"
"Probably."
"You might tell him the Blue House was busted this morning for drugs."
"Yeah. You had a rave up down there just yesterday, didn't you?
Nasties in the bedsheet bunch. Saw it on television, I did.
What's going to happen tomorrow?"
"That's always the question, isn't it?"
"That's what makes a horse race."
"Damn," said Fletch. "I didn't think you knew what makes a horse race."
And Fletch did not mind telephoning Chief of Detectives Roz Natchman at that early hour. Police stations are supposed to be open for 24-hour-a-day service. If she wasn't there yet, he should be able to leave a message. But she was there.
"Aren't you getting any sleep at all, Chief?"
"Thank you for your concern, Mr. Fletcher."
"Thank you."
"For what?"
"Staging that drug bust this morning, here at the Blue House. I'm sure I'll figure out why in a minute. Trying to discover who's sleeping with whom. You could have asked. You did before."
"How's the weather in Key West?"
"Nice."
"It's nice here, too."
"Having John Meade busted in Key West for a few quaaludes is not nice of you."
"John Meade?"
"He could end up with a jail sentence, you know. He's a big name. Make good headlines for the authorities in Key West."
"Was he in illegal possession of a controlled substance?"
"That's why he's being held."
"I'm sorry. Loved him in Easy River."
"So did he. He won't be able to use his talents to give you much more pleasure if he's in the hoosegow."
"So I'll see Easy River again. It's on the TV all the time. Now, regarding that question you asked, regarding Stephen Peterman's car?"
"Yes."
"We had it checked out. The car was in the parking lot on Bonita Beach, a blue Cadillac.
A rented car? Yes. No damage, not a scrape. So, that's the end of that great line of investigation. What date did he rent the car? There was a long silence from Chief of Detectives Roz Natchman. That's a good point. Are you trying to get ahead of me, Mr. Fletcher? Would you expect him to keep a damaged car, a damaged rented car? I wonder what date he actually arrived in Florida. I don't know. I should think you'd know by now. I would, too. Okay. So that line of investigation is still open? We'll check further. Another thing. You must know that yesterday we had a sort of a riot here, a demonstration, some violence. It was in all the papers, on TV, everybody's name mentioned but yours. Who are you, Mr. Fletcher? Chief, one of these groups might really have been trying to stop this film. I mean, to the point of murder. Jerry Littleford said last night that he had received threatening letters and phone calls. Does he have any of the letters? No, but the riot yesterday, Stella Littleford did get hurt. Some of these people can be vicious, insanely vicious. Vicious, but not smart. I don't think your average bigoted tub of lard is up to getting on location and then making a knife magically appear between the ribs of somebody sitting on a well-lit stage in daylight surrounded by cameras. Do you, Earwig? No. Keep trying, Earwig. Things are looking worse and worse for your Ms. Moxie Mooney. I need a devil's advocate. What do you mean? Well, all those film experts we hired, they're coming down pretty heavily on her. That dance she did. What dance? Didn't you see her? Thought you were there. What dance? Just before the, you know, murder, Moxie Mooney got up from her chair and did a little dance. She was showing Dan Buckley some little dance step she did in a Broadway hit. In her bathrobe? Makeup robe, dressing gown, whatever you want to call it. It's terry cloth. We have it. I should think it would be too big for her. So she couldn't have done it. So she could have. After she did her little dance step, she went back to her own chair, crossing behind where Peterman and Buckley were sitting. She crossed behind them. Yes, behind. It's in all the videotapes. In fact, it looks a little unnatural. From where she finished her dance, she could have walked directly back to her chair or behind Peterman and Buckley. She chose to walk behind them. Oh, God. The experts have drawn lines all over the stage floor. They talk in cubes. Do you understand that? No. Neither do I. Upshot of it is, they said it would have been more direct and more natural for her to walk in front of the men. It looks a little unnatural to me. But keep trying, Earwig. Believe me, I'd rather find some group of crazies guilty of murder than Moxie Mooney. This is not the way I want to become a famous detective. Are there any other leads you're following? Sure, but let me keep a few secrets, will you? Again, I warn you, Fletcher, don't you and Ms. Mooney leave Key West except to come back here. I hear you. Some people were a little nervous when you went sailing yesterday. You know about that? The Coast Guard did a helicopter over you. Oh, no. Oh, yes. They said you were real cute together. Said it was just like watching a movie. Chapter 31. Cats will bark before I ever accept an invitation to stay in your house again, Mr. What's-Your-Name Fletcher, Edith Howell stated at breakfast. What cats? Asked Cy Collar. Sam cats or jock cats? They were crowded at the white iron-framed glass table on the cistern in the backyard of the Blue House. Moxie had not yet come down to breakfast. A riot out of control one morning? People throwing rocks at the house, bopping poor Stella with a bottle. Why didn't you call the police? Jock cats always barked, Cy Collar said. He barked all the time. A police raid this morning at dawn? They came right into my bedroom while I was sleeping. I threw my aspirin bottle at the damned cop. Hit him, too, right on the cheek.
Sam cats never barked. Sam was a pussy cat.
Then they yank John off and charge him with being in possession of medicine or something.
Are you saying we were raided by the police this morning? Frederick Mooney asked.
We were, Freddy.
Edith put her hand on his.
Isn't it terrible?
Mooney extricated his hand to deal with the grapefruit. Never heard a thing.
They swarmed all over the house, Freddy, Edith said.
Like roaches, grinned Jerry Littleford.
You mean they entered and searched my bedroom while I slept? Freddy asked.
Yes, dear, commiserated Edith.
How forward of them, said Freddy. I trust I was sleeping well.
I'm sure you were sleeping handsomely, dear.
Lopez poured orange juice into Fletcher's glass. Global cable news is on the phone. Tell them I'll call them back, please.
Fletcher, Edith Howell asked, do you realize one of your house guests is in the hospital and another is in prison?
We're dropping like flies, Collar said through a mouthful of scrambled egg.
Roaches, said Jerry Littleford.
You Yanks don't see the comic side of anything, Jeff McKenzie said.
Cy Collar stopped chewing and stared at him.
Moxie appeared in her bikini with a light, wide-open linen top.
Good morning, sweets,
Edith gushed. Jerry Littleford squeezed against Cy Collar to make room for her. Fletch hitched his chair sideways, one leg stuck in a crack. Looking down, he jumped the chair leg out of the crack. On top of the cistern was a half-meter cut square. East and west on the square were hinged lift rings.
Did you sleep? Mooney asked his daughter. I heard there was a disturbance.
Lopez was back with a fresh pot and poured Moxie's coffee.
Anybody know how these old cisterns work? Asked Fletch.
Might as well get it over, Moxie said. She sipped her black coffee. I've heard from the producers.
She gave Fletch a long, solemn look, warning him not to correct her.
The production is canceled.
Thus was almost everybody at breakfast fired. Jeffrey McKenzie had already been fired. Mooney did not permit the silence to last too long. Is that the production of Midsummer Night's Dream, daughter?
Oh, El,
she said in exasperation.
That's too bad.
Mooney's eyes ran up the banyan tree. I was rather hoping to be offered a part.
But why?
Edith had caught her breath.
Everything was going so well.
Moxie snorted.
Well, at least I think so, and I'm sure John would back me up if he weren't in jail for medicine. My part was the best I've had in a long time. I was doing so well at it, with the help of dear Cy, of course.
Who did you speak to? Jerry Littleford asked.
Didn't quite catch the name, Moxie answered. It was a legitimate phone call.
Cy Collar asked, Why did they call you?
I just happened to answer the phone.
Moxie Mooney was lying well.
We're all relieved of our contracts as of today.
Fired, Jerry Littleford said.
Ah, the vicissitudes of this business, consoled Mooney.
But it's not fair, said Edith. I sublet my apartment in New York. I gave up a perfectly good, legitimate theater offer. Where will I go? What will I do? Freddy?
Yes?
Mooney answered formally, stiff-arming being called upon.
Well, Mackenzie,
Cy Collar looked the man straight in the eyes. Looks like your suit against Jumping Cow Productions won't be much good to you now.
Damned fools.
Mackenzie had reddened beneath his tan.
Too cheap to take a few days' proper mourning for the director's wife, yet when a few congenital idiots wrap themselves in bedsheets and throw a few rocks at a house, they collapse and cancel the production, losing everything they've invested in it.
Are such things insured? Fletch asked.
You've got to look at the comic side of things, Mackenzie, Cy Collar said.
Collar was not laughing or smiling or looking at all pleased.
It's the bad publicity that killed it, Moxie said.
The man said,
There's no such thing as bad publicity, said Edith Howell. Especially these days. Any publicity is good, the more the better.
Murder, riots, raids.
Why, we've been top of the news 3 days running, and the film isn't even made yet.
Freddy, tell them there's no such thing as bad publicity. It's not only the bad publicity, Moxie said. The press has begun to refer to Midsummer Night's Madness as a badly written, cheaply produced exploitation picture. The film will never live down its reputation now.
Even if you use my script, Mackenzie said. Even if I direct. I don't want anything to do with it.
Collar smiled.
And thus dies a lawsuit. We all heard you say that, Mackenzie. We're all witnesses.
Jerry Littleford asked quietly, Are they saying this picture exploits the race issue?
Moxie took a deep breath.
Yes, of course. Somebody must have gotten a hold of a script. Gratuitous violence in black and white and color.
Everyone can do with a bit of a rest, I'm sure, said Mooney. It's been a trying time.
Freddy, not me, squeaked Edith. You have no idea of my income the last year or two. I don't have your money, Freddy.
Indeed not, agreed Mooney.
No one was eating. Moxie had eaten nothing. Collar, Mackenzie, and Littleford had stopped eating, and food was left on their plates. Mooney, however, had cleaned his plate twice. Mooney blinked his eyes bright at the group.
Anyone for a drink? Hair of the dog, Collar said to his plate.
Eye-opener, said Mackenzie.
Anything, said Edith Howell.
Damn all cows, jumping or otherwise, and their milk.
Trying times, said Mooney.
Jerry Littleford said, Well, whoever was trying to stop this production succeeded. Chapter 32.
If John Meade turns state's evidence, Fletch asked carefully, will you drop whatever charges there are outstanding against him?
He did not know where the police station in Key West was, so he had taken a taxi. He also wanted to be there before too many papers had been filed in regarding Meade, and before too many newspapers had been filled in regarding Meade. Sergeant Hennings had appeared as soon as Fletch asked the desk man if he could see him. Apparently, the sergeant did not raid an office, maybe not even a desk. They were sitting on a bench at the side of the police station lobby.
What evidence? Sergeant Hennings asked.
He doesn't have it yet, Fletch answered, because I haven't given it to him yet.
Evidence about what?
Look, Sergeant, you didn't raid the Blue House this morning just to bust a beloved movie actor for a few quaaludes.
That's right, the sergeant said. I didn't.
He stood up.
You want some coffee?
No, thanks.
The sergeant wandered behind the counter and into the back room. When he returned, he had a half-empty styrofoam cup of coffee in his hand.
You're saying you think you know something you can use to get Meade off the hook?
No, Fletch said. Sorry, I don't know it. I have an idea.
Why didn't you tell me before, when I was at the house this morning?
Because I didn't have the idea this morning. I hadn't noticed something. And I hadn't noticed it because I wasn't suspicious before you showed up.
You're being mighty foxy.
No, I'm offering you cooperation.
For a price.
John Meade doesn't belong in your jail, and you know it. Every time you cops bust an admired person for drugs, you're making drug-taking seem more admirable, more acceptable, and you know it. You're doing the same thing an advertising agency would be doing, hiring John Meade to advertise soft drinks or chewing tobacco.
So people who are famous shouldn't be arrested?
That's not what I'm saying. There are no special rules, I guess. Maybe there are. I don't know. If you've got a real case, you have to do something about it. Otherwise, you've got to look at the end result of what you're doing. Just like everybody else, it's called prudence.
Busting John Meade is imprudent.
It's stupid. It sells drugs. Is it the object of the police to sell drugs?
Never heard this argument before.
Maybe I've been a movie star hanger-on too long, all of 3 days.
Sergeant Hennings sat down.
What do you want to say?
I want to see John Meade.
Let me see if I've got this right. You want to tell John Meade something he can use to turn state's evidence, as you call it, to get himself off?
Right.
Technically not correct.
Sorry.
In other words, you're saying if we let John Meade go, you'll tell us something that might be useful.
Let him go and destroy all papers relating to his ever having been in this police station.
Why don't you just tell me directly?
Why don't you make the damn deal?
Oh. Sergeant Henning smiled. Okay.
Okay?
Okay. I swear to it on my grandmother's grave.
Was your grandmother a nice lady?
The best.
The owner of the Blue House is Ted Sills.
I know that.
Ted distinctly did not want to rent the Blue House to me. I forced him. I needed to get Moxie somewhere, not too far away from Fort Myers, where she could recuperate.
From Peterman's murder?
Yeah, peace and quiet.
You've had a lot of that.
Not much. Finally, Sills suggested an exorbitant rent. I surprised him by agreeing to it.
How much?
You wouldn't believe. Anyway, as soon as he sees on the television that Frederick and Moxie Mooney are staying in the Blue House and crowds and news cameras are collecting outside, he calls up and starts screaming. He sounds like a puppy with a bone suddenly surrounded by the neighborhood mongrels.
Can't blame him.
Sergeant, he doesn't want attention attracted to that house, any kind of attention. He calls time and again, each time getting more shrill, more threatening. Last time he called, he said he was coming after me with a shotgun.
And yet you stayed.
I had a choice. How do you move someone out like Edith Howell? Getting old Mooney out of a bar requires the tact and logistical brains of an Eisenhower.
Chuck told me. Threatened him with Jesse James.
This morning you raided the Blue House.
And found nothing.
Glad to hear you say that. After you left, I called Ted Sills to report to him his house had been raided. Well, sir, he left the country suddenly last night when he was supposed to be at a horse race today.
Yeah, Fletcher, you've got the point. We think Sills is a big volume drug runner. So when are you going to get to the news?
It hits me that Ted Sills doesn't want attention drawn to the Blue House because there are drugs in it. This morning, you guys searched the place. No drugs.
No drugs at all.
Glad to hear you say that.
Fletch focused his eyes across the room and blinked.
John Meade going to be released?
On my grandmother's grave.
All reports regarding him destroyed?
I'll eat them for lunch with mayonnaise. Where's the heroin?
Fletch looked at the sergeant. I don't really know.
Great. Why am I sitting here talking to a...
A what?
I don't know what.
During breakfast, I noticed that on the surface of the cistern in the backyard of the Blue House is what looks to me like a trap door. Because of the salt in the air, whatnot, I can't tell if the trap door is newer than the cistern, you know? The lift rings are rusted. I also don't know how cisterns work.
They have to be cleaned.
I do know the Lopez's tell me the Blue House hasn't used cistern water since the water treatment plant was built over on Stock Island.
Did you lift the hatch and look in the cistern?
No.
Why not?
I'm not a cop. Besides, Fletch said, if I found there weren't any drugs in the cistern, I wouldn't have anything to talk with you about.
Geez, no wonder you get along with those flaky movie stars.
I don't, really. Edith Howell says she'll never visit me again. I'm all broken up about it.
I bet. She threw an aspirin bottle at Officer Owen King, raised a welt on his cheek. Would have brought her in for assaulting an officer, but the lady happened to be in bed when she threw the bottle. Actual fact, the incident might have caused tittering in the courtroom.
Must maintain the dignity of the fuzz.
You said it.
Do I have a good idea?
Worth checking out.
Sergeant Hennings stood up and started to amble toward the back room again. Are you bringing Mr. Meade out?
Sure, Sergeant Hennings said. Soon as he finishes autographing everybody's gun belts.
Chapter 33. Fletch stood on the second floor back balcony of the Blue House, his hands on the railing. He was watching the policeman in the backyard. Sergeant Hennings was directing the removal of furniture from the top of the cistern. Downstairs in the living room, a morning cocktail party was in progress. Edith Howell, Cy Collar, and Frederick Mooney stood in a close triangle, drinks in their hands, drinks in their heads, out shouting reminiscences at each other.
It wasn't Olivier who said that. I was there at the time.
Jeffrey Mackenzie sat alone at the side of the room, sipping from a glass of dark whiskey. John Meade had gone to the kitchen for a late breakfast or an early lunch. Mrs. Lopez said Jerry Littleford had gone to the hospital to collect Stella. Lopez had gone to the hardware store to buy window glass. Moxie was sitting in the bedroom staring at a game show on television. In the backyard, two policemen lifted the hatch easily. Sergeant Hennings looked down and then knelt down and reached into the cistern. He pulled up one plastic bag, then another. He looked up at Fletch on the balcony and gave the thumbs up sign. Fletch waved back. The fog is beginning to clear. In the bedroom, Fletch flicked off the television. Sitting with her legs in the double-width chair, Moxie simply looked at him. The cops just found a lot of heroin, I guess it is, in the cistern in the backyard. Her expression remained blank. Did you help them find it?
Sure.
Why? I don't like heroin. I don't like people who import heroin illegally. I don't like people who sell heroin to other people. I don't see how it helps me. Then she shook her head with distaste at what she had just said. You said I have to think of myself now. You do, but things are beginning to become clearer. Listen, Moxie, this is my best guess at the moment. He remained standing in the bedroom. Steve Peterman and Ted Sills were friends. We knew that. They were also in business together. We didn't know that. Smuggling shit. Yeah, I would say Sills was on the smuggling end of it. Peterman was the financial end. Sills used the Blue House as a stash, which is why he owns it, which is why the Lopezes have been so lonely. The house isn't really used for anything else, except maybe... Fletch grinned ruefully at himself. To entertain damned fools who can be talked into investing in slow racehorses. Peterman was moving an awful lot of money around, in and out of the country, from banks in Honduras, Colombia, to banks in Switzerland, France, under the name of Jumping Cow Productions, and most regrettably, under your own name. Moxie, you were being used like a laundry. An awful lot of money was being washed, at least loosened up, freed, moved, under your name. Did they think they could get away with it forever? Moxie, they didn't give one damn about you. That's nice. I would say that in order to make Jumping Cow Productions continue looking like a viable film company, Peterman ultimately knew he had to make a film, or appear to be making a film. But a successful film would only draw attention to Jumping Cow Productions. So he was purposely making a bad film.
Purposely.
She sighed. A film so bad it couldn't even be released. It must have blown his mind when Talk at Cross actually hired a good director, Jeff Mackenzie, who then showed up with a good script. Moxie almost laughed. Dear Steve. That put him in quite a pickle. He had to get rid of Mackenzie and bring in a washed-out director who would film a bad script exactly as it was written, badly. Okay, okay. Are you saying Sills murdered Peterman? I don't think so. Sills wasn't even on location. He couldn't have been. He could have had someone get on location and kill Peterman. But why would Sills want to kill Peterman? Trouble between them? Clearly, Sills isn't better off with Peterman dead. He hightailed it to France last night. At least the way things have worked out, he isn't better off. Moxie was distinctly looking tired. What are you telling me, Fletch?